From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, Michigan's spending money to attract big events. What are we getting back?
Anytime you sort of give money, you know, these little goodies to bring these kinds of things in, you say, oh boy, is that, do we really need to be doing that?
We meet a Michigan physicist searching for dark matter and dark energy, hoping to understand our universe.
Dark energy is really, really weird. It is causing the universe expansion to accelerate.
A preview of this weekend's Detroit Jazz Festival, 35 years and going strong.
And the fact that the festival, after all these decades, has been able to maintain an all-jazz festival and that remains free to the public is downright astounding.
Those stories and much more today on Stateside. State money is being spent to attract everything from a Jehovah's Witnesses convention in downtown Detroit to a huge international soccer match in Ann Arbor. I'm Cynthia Canty. How much money should Michigan spend to lure these so-called super events? And is the payoff really worth it? That story today on Stateside. And then we'll head north and explore a one-of-a-kind Pickle House Museum. But first, there is a lot at stake for the Michigan Education Association. That's because teachers and school workers who are MEA members have until this Sunday to decide whether to remain in their union. Dave Eggert covers Lansing for the Associated Press. Dave, this is really the first big litmus test for right to work in Michigan, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. The MEA is basically Michigan's largest public sector union. You know, and the right to work law has been in effect since March 2013. But this is seen as a good litmus test because it's a big union and it actually has like a one-month window every year where members can decide whether they want to drop out or not.
And I know that efforts are certainly underway to convince teachers and staffers to go on one side of this issue or the other. I happen to notice in last Sunday's Free Press, a big full-page ad from Americans for Prosperity. Tell us about that.
Yeah, Americans for Prosperity, which is a conservative group financially backed by the Koch brothers and other conservatives, they were big proponents of the right-to-work law and helped pass it. And they essentially want to make sure that teachers know their options. There's been a lot of back and forth on both sides as to whether or not the union is adequately telling their members about this August window or not.
And is the MEA doing anything very obvious to try to convince members to stay?
Yeah, I mean, you know, they've got some advantages in that ever since the law passed, you know, they can kind of work inside schools and they have 1,100 local bargaining units around the state. You know, you've got teachers that are in charge of those unions, and they kind of have the advantage of personal relationships with teachers and being able to explain to them, hey, you know, this is what we do for you. This is what the union can provide. They've also set up a website for members and I think are mailing them as well, kind of saying, look, the groups that are trying to persuade you to get out of the union don't necessarily have your best interest at stake.
So with about 112,000 active members, is there anyone hazarding a guess as to how many members might opt out?
No one really knows. I mean, in the first opt-out window last August, there were about 1,500 members that dropped out. They've got about 150,000 members when you include retirees, so that's like 1% of their membership. But, you know, that opt-out window was not widely known at the time. But I think now with the law being in effect and each year, people will probably be more familiar with it.
When do we find out how many will have opted out? Have they said when they'll announce it?
Well, I think they'll know in September. I think the question is whether the Michigan Education Association wants to make that public or not. They don't necessarily have to do that. It's a private membership association. But there are ways ultimately it can come out through some of these lawsuits that are ongoing. They found out the Mackinac Center in Midland, which is one group that's pretty involved with promoting the right to work law. They have data that show that 8,000 teachers were not paying dues last year, even when they had not dropped out, because there's actually a related law that Republicans passed in Lansing that says you can no longer deduct dues from paychecks. So the union's been dealing with that as well. So I don't know. I think that's going to be the big question is how many people drop out this August and every August from now on.
Dave Eggert covers Lansing for the Associated Press. Always good to talk with you, Dave. Thanks so much.
Hey, thank you.
You hear the name Smithsonian. Chances are you think of the famed museums in Washington, D.C. Well, think again. A 57-acre stand of trees in Livingston County has been added to a global network that has a distinguished name, the Smithsonian Institution's Forest Global Earth Observatory. The plot is all part of the University of Michigan's Edwin S. George Reserve. Christopher Dick is the director, and he joins us now. What exactly is this network of trees?
Okay, well, it started back in Panama in 1982. Researchers were interested in understanding how there could be so many tree species packed in such small areas of rainforest. And in order to understand that and just to document the sort of the staggering species diversity, they began to put out large-scale forest inventory plots. And the first one was set up in Barro, Colorado Island, Panama, and it was 50 hectares. And researchers learned so much from that forest, and it attracted so many researchers from around the world that other countries began putting up their own plots, becoming part of this Smithsonian network. And so originally, the network was focused only on tropical areas, but then China came on board, and they wanted to be part of it with their temperate forests, and then Europe, and then finally, North America has gotten involved. And now our plot represents the 10th North American plot of the Smithsonian.
What is it about this 57-acre stand of trees that made it perfect? I mean, you've got how many acres at the entire reserve?
The entire reserve is about 1,300 acres, okay. But about a fourth of that is sort of mature, undisturbed forest. And what makes this stand exceptionally important for us from a research standpoint is that we've had researchers from the University of Michigan working there intensively since about 1930. So we know a lot about these forests. It's completely protected, and we have a large critical mass of students and faculty members from Michigan and elsewhere who would like to use this forest, and that's what makes it important.
What does joining the Smithsonian Network mean for researchers, for you and your team of researchers?
So what it means is that we now have a standardized way of comparing data from forests from around the world. We measure the same size categories of trees. Everything above 1 centimeter of stem diameter at breast height gets measured and mapped down to the last square meter. We put the data in the same format and share it with other researchers. It makes it really useful for comparative studies of forest dynamics.
And I know it took a lot of work to make this all happen. I want to ask you, did I read this correctly, that this plot is the size of 43 football fields, and there were more than 45,000 trees that had to be tagged, measured, and mapped?
That's right. We had 12 students from Middlebury College and from University of Michigan, because our supervising biologist, Dave Allen, is actually from Middlebury College, but he was a U of M alumnus and did his PhD work in this forest. So we had those 12 students working full-time for 2 months, mapping about a little more than 1,000 trees per football field size of area of forest. These students were great. They sweated. They were bitten by mosquitoes, black flies. They went through swamps, invasive species, poison ivy, all kinds of things. They did a great job and learned a lot.
Doing their bit for science.
Yeah.
Tell us about the trees that are in this stand.
This is what we call an oak hickory forest. So if you look at the large trees in the forest, it's dominated by species of oaks and hickories. And this is a very common forest type in eastern North America and also especially in southern Michigan. And we think that it was actually created by Native Americans because this kind of forest can only survive with a certain frequency of fire. And we don't get that frequency of fire naturally. And so we think that these are sort of the remnants, the legacy of Native American fire practices. And so when we look at the forest, when we look at the actual tree stems that we've measured, we can see that the oaks and the hickories are the largest trees in the plot. A lot of these trees are over 100 years old, but they're not represented in the understory. So they're very uncommon as seedlings and saplings.
Is that the understory?
Yep, that's the understory.
The babies, the next generation?
That's right, below the canopy. And so what we find actually in the understory are huge numbers of red maple and black cherry. And so it looks like our forest is in a major period of transition when the oak hickory forest is being replaced by red maple and black cherry and species that are otherwise vulnerable to fire.
Hmm.
So we're seeing that natural process happening as a result of the changing vegetation history.
Now, if one forest tells a story, what kinds of stories and patterns will you all be looking for now that you can compare this stand of trees in Livingston County and forests in places like China and Brazil and Indonesia? What are you looking for?
So from a global perspective, I think everybody is interested in what's happening to forests as a result of increased atmospheric carbon.
Climate change.
Yep, climate change. And one aspect of it that's affecting the whole world is the increase in carbon. And so we expect actually for a lot of forests, whether they're tropical or temperate, to experience increased production of wood, increased biomass, increased growth rates if they can take
it. Because there's so much carbon available.
Yeah, if they can take it up and incorporate it. In the temperate areas, so in China, Europe, North America, they experience winters. What we're seeing is an extended growing season. There's more time, a longer summer, so more time for these trees to grow and add biomass.
Is that a good thing for the trees?
Potentially. And it might not be good for all trees because not all trees, not all populations or species are going to be adapted to last a summer that's 2 months longer. So those,
and warmer.
Yes, those species that are not well adapted to last for this longer growing period will probably be replaced by species that can adapt. Those might be more southern species, species more, that you're more likely to find in Ohio or Arkansas. They might start taking over the forest. Those are things that we want to watch for.
If you and I were having this conversation in 100 years, what do you think that stand of trees is going to look like?
Depends a little bit on what happens to precipitation in Michigan. So if we still have a lot of precipitation, a lot of rain, there's always moisture available to these forests, we might see something that looks a little bit more like a tropical forest, very lush, beautiful. But if it goes into the other direction and if we have less precipitation, it's already a very dry forest now with very dry soils. So we might see something that's not even forested at all.
That is terrifying. That really is. And I'm guessing that it goes without saying that this beautiful stand of trees that kind of takes us back to Michigan way back isn't available to the public to go tromping through.
No, but it's very similar to the forests that are found in the Pinckney Recreation Area and also in Waterloo. And so people should get out and really enjoy those forests.
Christopher Dick is an associate professor of ecology and evolutionary biology at the University of Michigan. And he directs the Edwin S. George Reserve. And that's where a 57-acre research plot has just become part of a Smithsonian Institution Global Research Network. Professor, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
If jazz speaks to you in any way, downtown Detroit is the place to be this weekend. The largest free jazz festival in the world happens at Campus Martius and Hart Plaza. It's the 35th annual Detroit Jazz Festival. Chris Collins is the artistic director. Welcome.
Thank you, Cindy.
And Jim Gallert is a longtime jazz broadcaster, writer, researcher, and just out-and-out lover of jazz. Jim, it's so good to have you with us.
Well, thank you very much.
Chris, I have to tell you, I did a double take when I was looking at notes and realized it's the 35th Detroit Jazz Festival, because that first one in 1980 doesn't seem that long ago, does it?
No, it really doesn't. And, you know, for anyone that grew up in this community, the Detroit Jazz Festival has become part of the cultural landscape every year. I know for me as a young musician, it was one of the first exposures where I could see my heroes in person, in the flesh. And to do that for free, and the fact that the festival, after all these decades, has been able to maintain not only one of the largest festivals in the world, but an all-jazz festival, and that remains free to the public, is downright astounding and something we should all cherish.
And this festival has really helped Detroit lay claim to being a world-class jazz city, hasn't it?
Well, yeah, you know, few cities in the world can brag about their connection to the legacy of jazz music. Detroit, the unique personality of the city, the fact that gospel music, blues, and even pop forms have been so prevalent in the city of Detroit, mixed together with families. You know, a lot of cats still listen to Coltrane in the household, Nancy Wilson. That wears off on the youth, and we have found there's still a powerful production propagation of young artists in Detroit. So the Detroit Jazz Festival celebrates not only the greater jazz landscape, but in particular this amazing legacy of the city of Detroit and all the wonderful artists that have come from here and the ones that are still coming from here.
Jim Gallagher,
that's right, Chris.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. Actually, Detroit sort of came on the jazz map in the early 1920s when it started producing big ensembles, big bands, and a couple of them were as good as anything put out by Manhattan, which tended to think of itself as the center of jazz and everything else in America. But Detroit was a very important feeder city. A lot of our bands set the style for bands in New York. And in the 1930s, and especially in the 1940s, when Detroiters started coming of age, they passed through our wonderful educational system that we had in place. They really started making an impression on New York musicians, especially in the 1950s.
And then thinking of other areas, we've had a lot of Detroit jazz musicians making their mark and crossing over into other genres of music. I'm thinking like of the Funk Brothers, who played on most every Motown hit. And those guys all came from jazz, didn't they, Jim?
jazz and blues with some gospel thrown in. Many of us think of Detroit as being the New Orleans of the North because there are so many musicians that are so creative in so many different genres of music that you can get these wonderful mixes, and Motown is a perfect example of that.
Is there a sound, is there a feel that marks the jazz that's made in Detroit today that makes it different from what you might hear in other cities, Chris?
Well, yeah, I've always said, you know, the Detroit jazz thing, you know, growing up as a musician, the first thing you learn here is that there's an open-mindedness about all musics and creative arts out of Detroit. It is part and parcel for the feeling of the city in general. But when it comes to jazz, there is a great respect for Byrd and Diz and the whole bebop era, mixed with a healthy dose of rhythm and blues, the gospel element that's so strong in our churches here in Detroit. In addition to that, a sense of freedom, the avant-garde, pushing the envelope, finding the edge of stylistic traditions, and indeed going beyond them, this amalgamation of styles that not only allow the Detroit jazz musicians to function and lead the way in the jazz world, but also to be powerful musicians in these other areas that you speak of, these other genres. I will tell you, the Jazz Festival celebrates this in a very specific way. The last 3 years, we have something called the Homecoming Series, where every year I go out into the greater jazz community and really try to keep tabs on all the wonderful musicians that have come from the Detroit scene and gone on to become significant national artists. This year, our Homecoming Series includes one of the great legends, the wonderful Barry Harris Trio will be with us on Saturday. Regina Carter and her Southern Comfort group, the East Gypsy Band with Tim Reese, a wonderful saxophonist, the great bassist, legendary bassist Ron Carter will be with us, all carrying the torch of the Detroit homecoming concept. And then topping it off on Monday, Jimmy Wilkins, 92 years old, coming into play, the music of Ernie Wilkins, his brother, with the Detroit Jazz Fest Orchestra, and all those homecoming guests, Barry and Regina and Tim, they're all going to join us. It's going to be a big party on main stage on Monday for Detroit.
You know, the other thing that makes the festival special is we can stage, and we do stage, a jazz festival with primarily Detroit musicians. You know, when we have a homecoming, we have so many musicians that have come from Detroit. If we just bring a fraction of them back, that's, in anyone's book, is immediately a great jazz festival.
On top of all the huge names you're still pulling in from everywhere.
Absolutely.
And, you know, and a good example of that is one of our homecoming artists, the great Frida Payne, that everyone knows from her pop career. Frida sent me this killer new record on Mack Avenue label that is her singing jazz with big band, and it's all Bill Cunliffe arrangements. She's going to do Saturday night with the Airmen of Note big band, all these wonderful new arrangements no one's ever heard before. Some of the music, by the way, composed by Gretchen Laid and Tom Robinson, two of our primary supporters. So a real homecoming in that sense. And then on top of it, she has agreed to present our 2014 Detroit Youth Diva winner. And this is a young lady. We have competitions every year for young women out of Detroit, high school age, to compete to sing jazz. And if they win, they are prepared to sing with big band. This year, that winner will perform along Frida Payne during her set with the Airmen of Note big band. Talk about a way to fold in the past legacy, the diversity of genres that Detroit artists participate in, and then the youth generation that's coming out of the current creative atmosphere of Detroit.
We're looking ahead to the upcoming 35th Detroit Annual Detroit Jazz Festival happening Labor Day weekend at Campus Martius in Hart Plaza downtown as we talk with Artistic Director Chris Collins and Jim Gallert, who is a longtime jazz writer, researcher, broadcaster. And you were starting to take us to this topic of nurturing the talent and also spreading the gospel of jazz around Michigan, and you do this all year, so this is not just a Labor Day weekend event. Tell us what's happening elsewhere in the year.
Well, you know, one of the most important things we do is our educational outreach. And when we talk about education, it's not just to youth, although that's an important component. It's to high school, middle school, college-age students. With Jim and his talk tent, he'll tell you all about it. It's education to the masses. But all year round, we work in the Detroit Public Schools with a thing called Jazz Infusion, where we embrace the great legacy of Cass Tech and Renaissance and the DSA and Duke Ellington Middle School, Bates Academy. And we have professional artists like Wendell Harris and Marion Hayden and Russ Miller and Chuck Newsom. They go into the schools twice a week. They teach. They roll up their sleeves. They get bands to happen, and they celebrate the wonderful legacy of Detroit Public Schools. We also have, in cooperation, Wayne State University and the J.C. Hurd Family Legacy, something called the J.C. Hurd Jazz Week at Wayne, which through audition, 40 students absolutely for free. You cannot pay to go to this. You cannot buy your way in. You have to go in on talent. They get a whole week of instruction by all the jazz artists in Detroit. They perform at the clubs and at venues around the city. And from that, an all-star group is selected that represent the best of instrumental jazz artists in the high school community who will perform on Monday at the Detroit Jazz Fest. And it shows this real deep connection and commitment the Jazz Festival has to the youth and spreading the mentor-disciple relationship, which is so important to this music throughout the youth community.
Jim Gellert, it strikes me that planting these kinds of seeds is so crucial to growing not only future musicians but future fans. And when we think about how many school districts have sadly had to cut back or even eliminate their instrumental music programs, somebody's got to step up.
That's exactly right, and we are trying to do that. We are doing that, in fact. And what's beautiful is that continues another tradition in Detroit's music community. The Detroit way is older musicians show the younger musicians. You know, they guide them along. They make sure they have their fundamentals together. They teach them how to play at jam sessions. So we have both formal and informal music academies in Detroit. And what Chris is doing is a great example of a more formal approach. We get the kids together, we reward them, let them play, let them learn by playing with the pros. And that's a wonderful thing. Cindy, one other thing we've got going on at the festival is called the Jazz Talk Tent, which is what myself and my longtime friend and colleague Lars Bjorn spend so much time programming every year. We have interviews with many of the musicians who are appearing at the festival because they have verbal stories to tell. They tell stories with their instruments, but there's also stories of their lives and who they listen to and all these other details that people like me and Chris find absolutely fascinating. We also have presentations. We've got two gentlemen from New York coming in. One of them is the archivist at Louis Armstrong House named Ricky Riccardi.
Huh.
And he's, I know it's close.
It is.
and he's written a great book called What a Wonderful World, The Magic of Louis Armstrong's Later Years, which he's researched for decades. And he's going to be presenting rare audio and video material on Armstrong's later years. And it's a fascinating book. I've read it. Then we have a longtime friend and supporter named Bob Porter, who's a Grammy Award-winning broadcaster on WBGO. And he's written many Grammy Award-winning liner notes. And he has a book coming out next year on soul jazz. So we brought in some big guns from the big city to help us out in the Jazz Talk Tent.
So people are welcome to come in and hear these discussions and hear these interviews and maybe even some performances.
They are encouraged to do that, and we do have some performances, in fact. We have a nice conversation going on in a performance with Diane Schur on Sunday morning. We have Detroit's artiste Kate Patterson is going to be performing in the tent on Monday. You know, we've got just tons of things going on. So you can come down, you can eat, you can hear some music, you can take a break for a half hour in the talk tent and listen to something and learn, and then you can go on and hear some more music. It's a three-day vacation.
And it's free. That's what's awesome, too.
It's free. It's all free.
I'm curious, for both of you, the passion absolutely oozes out of every word you say. Jim, how old were you when you discovered jazz?
I was 18 years old. I heard Sun Ra at the Grandy Ballroom.
Oh, my.
If anyone remembers Sun Ra, I know Chris does.
Yeah. And what did it mean to you? What grabbed you?
I was just transfixed and transformed. I became the music chose me that night. I mean, you don't choose jazz. You know, the music chooses you. It puts a message inside of you, and it's there permanently. I've never known anybody to ever start listening to jazz and then suddenly wake up one morning and say, you know, I don't like listening to jazz anymore. It just doesn't happen.
Chris Collins, what about you? How old were you?
Well, I got into jazz because of the money and the fame.
But seriously,
yes,
folks.
But seriously, folks. No, I was a very young guy, about 10 years old, listening to father's old 78s. He had Coleman Hawkins and Lester Young and Benny Goodman trio stuff on an old jukebox in the basement. You know, I came into this world, this jazz world, as a musician, and that's probably how I'll come out. It was very much, I had to learn what they were doing. I had to understand what they were doing. And it's been consuming passion my entire life. So it's a beautiful, never-ending path of discovery. And, you know, a big part of that Jim alluded to is, you know, how do you come into this music? One of the ways we all share as an audience for musicians is something we call the jam session, which was where cats gather. And this is, you don't plan it. It is an education in itself for everyone there, and it is something we've embraced at the festival every night, Friday and Saturday. And Sunday, we have late-night jams that after the last stage closes at 10:45 till about 1 a.m. up at the Volt Bar and 42 degrees north in the Marriott Hotel for free. You can come in and not only hear the Detroiters playing, but all the National Cat Service house bands. So they're up there. You sit in with them. All the heavies are sitting in the audience listening and purveying. It is a real opportunity to mingle and to get to know what this music is about, to taste it in an environment that's welcoming, open, and my God, it's free.
What a great way for neophytes to soak it in and get a sense of it.
Indeed.
The Detroit Jazz Festival runs this Labor Day weekend in downtown Detroit. You can get all the schedules and lists of artists and all the information at DetroitJazzFest.com. Chris Collins is the artistic director, and Jim Gallert, we should note, will be hosting jazz discussions, interviews, and music performances in the Jazz Talk Tent at the festival. Thanks to both of you.
Thanks, Cynthia.
Thanks, Cindy.
Okay, imagine a pickle barrel. You know, the old-timey wooden barrels that held big fat pickles. Now imagine it 2 stories tall, 16 feet, with an 8-foot kitchen barrel attached. You would be picturing the Pickle Barrel House Museum in Grand Marais. Pat Munger is president of the Grand Marais Historical Society, and she joins us now from the UP. So, Pat, this museum is the actual shape of a giant pickle barrel. Who built it and why?
It was built originally for William Donahue, cartoonist and author of children's books from 1914 till 1972. His cartoons were about little teeny-weeny people who were 2 inches tall, and they lived in the woods around Grand Marais. He originally wrote for the Chicago Tribune, and then in his cartoons, and they were syndicated throughout the world. He also advertised for Monarch Food Company, and Monarch Foods did a lot of things with the little teeny-weeny people that he had. They included them on a lot of their packaging. They'd have a little picture of the teeny-weeny characters, and they'd say teeny-weeny sardines, teeny-weeny toffee, teeny-weeny pickles. And the pickles were at one point put into a kind of a promotional type thing back in the early 1920s. And in those, it was a little barrel, and they put pickles in them and sold them.
So teeny-weeny pickles in a teeny-weeny barrel.
Yes, it was. And then that kind of developed into more and more things using the pickle barrel, and he kind of became almost synonymous with the teeny weenies and the pickle barrel. And one of the owners of Monarch Foods was friends with William Donahue, so he is the one that built the pickle barrel house as a surprise for William's wife, Mary Donahue. And it was built out in the woods near Grand Marais on Saba Lake. And then the Donahues came up in 1927 is when it was built. So it was probably 1927 they came up, and they took them out into the woods and gave them the key. And they had a big celebration when they gave them the key to the pickle barrel and the pickle barrel house. They had all the little town's children, little children from Grand Marais, from the school, dress up as the teeny-weeny characters, and they all popped out of the woods, and they came and did a presentation to him.
It couldn't be cuter, the Pickle Barrel House Museum. It's right there on Lake Avenue in Grand Marais.
Yes.
And we've been talking to the president of the Grand Marais Historical Society, Pat Munger. So we're all going to look forward to when we get to the UP and get to Grand Marais, we're going to come and see this Pickle Barrel House Museum for ourselves. Pat, thank you so much for talking with us on Stateside.
Well, thank you for wanting to know more about our Pickle Barrel.
State money is being used to attract everything from a Jehovah's Witnesses convention in downtown Detroit to that big, big soccer match in Ann Arbor. As Tom Walsh, business columnist for the Detroit Free Press, explains, the Michigan Economic Development Corporation has spent more than $1 million this year to lure these super events, these conventions and sporting events. Tom, what's the reason for using state money like this?
Well, the reason that you hear from the people who put the program together is that everybody else is doing it. Every other city and state is doing it, and they all want these big events, these big conventions, and they're giving, you know, incentives to come do it. So, and we didn't have this in place until about a year ago.
Well, it's kind of interesting. This almost smacks to me a little bit of the film industry incentives. Let's get the film industry here. And that was deemed by, including Governor Snyder, some in Michigan, to say that didn't pay off. So do we feel that this is different and it is paying off?
Well, the comparison's a legitimate one. Governor Snyder came into office saying, you know, we'd sort of gone overboard with all of these tax credits and sort of mortgaged our future in a way because we made all these promises about, you know, money that we were going to forgive in the future. So now we're going to do away with these programs. And one of the programs was the film credits. Now they haven't done totally away with it. And instead of tax credits, they give specific cash incentives in some cases to films, not as much money as the tax credits amounted to before. And the same thing goes with other kinds of economic development incentives, whether it's Toyota expanding out in Ann Arbor or something else. They're opting to go for more direct, occasional payments to kind of close a deal, but even trying to avoid doing too much of that.
Well, do we know how much money that these events could generate for Michigan?
Well, what they say is in this particular case, the reason that we got the numbers was that they, on the strategic fund agenda meeting yesterday, one of the agenda items was they were modifying the memorandum of understanding that sort of appropriated this MEDC money, which they've been dishing out for about a year, about half a million for this first half a year, and then $1 million for the year that we're currently wrapping up, and then what they're asking for was another $1 million for next year to do this. And they say basically, you know, Texas, for example, has three or four different funds created by specific legislation, one for motorsports events, one for conventions, another one for, you know, other kind of big sporting events. So other states are doing this. So they said, we need something to help us close deals. We're in a better shape than we used to be because Cobo's been renovated in Detroit, and we've got the casino hotels down there now, and Grand Rapids has been doing some things out there. So it's not just for Detroit. Grand Rapids has gotten some athletic events, some AAU and NCAA events as a result of it, and I think I mentioned the Ann Arbor case of the big soccer match.
So even though the Detroit Bureau is administering the fund, it's open to convention and visitors bureaus all over Michigan.
It is, and everybody has kind of different thresholds. Part of it, you have to sort of meet some requirements. Most of the people coming in have to be from out of state and spending money from that wouldn't otherwise be coming here with all these visitors. So you have to sort of project that out. And the numbers that they need to justify a big Detroit event are higher than the ones in Ann Arbor or Grand Rapids if they have smaller populations and smaller venues. So they have kind of a sliding scale on that. So everybody gets to participate. Now, the payback, they say, at least in these first few events that they've done, I think they did 8 of them in the period that the memo was written about for this meeting yesterday. Mm-hmm. You know, they're saying they got, you know, in return for $1.1 million or something, they got nearly, you know, $20 million of state tax revenue from these events. That's money coming in terms of hotel motel taxes and other taxes to the state that might not have otherwise come. Now, you can argue, was this big soccer tournament going to turn its back on a record attendance at U of M Stadium just because they didn't get a closing deal of $40,000 to mm-hmm. help Ann Arbor throw a little celebration the day before? I don't know if we would have lost that business or not. You can make that argument, and some people certainly will. And I don't have a real breakdown either of exactly how that money is spent. I think it's spent mostly by the CVBs, as opposed to, you know, writing checks to the organization that's coming in, be it a soccer match or Jehovah's Witnesses.
Right, right. Because somehow I think, 40,000 to Manchester United or Real Madrid is pocket change. But you're absolutely right that to the Ann Arbor Visitors Bureau, it's a convention visitors bureau, it's a big chunk of money. I guess the bottom line, Tom, is there got to be people listening right now asking, really, is that worth it? Especially when we think of the roads, K-12 education needs.
Absolutely. That's always the case. Anytime you sort of, you know, give money, you know, these little goodies to bring these kinds of things in. You say, oh boy, is that, do we really need to be doing that? On the other hand, if you're in the trenches and you're working for the Convention Visitors Bureau and you're, you know, you're dealing with, you know, several decades of, you know, of bad press about Detroit and Michigan trying to get conventions and events to come here, you want every, you know, every tool in your toolbox you can, because you know that, you know, the people in Indianapolis or Milwaukee or San Antonio are saying, you know, what do you want to go to Detroit for? We got better stuff here, and we got some more goodies, some cash money that'll help grease the deal. So other people are doing it. That's always sort of been the case. I remember when John Engler came into office, he was sort of anti a lot of these programs, and after Michigan lost the Willow Run plant to Texas for a truck plant,
yes,
he changed his tune pretty quickly and started having a lot of these kind of programs. So,
and as Tom told us, this is not going to be the end of this practice, because just yesterday, as he said, the Michigan Strategic Fund said okay to another $1 million for this program through September 2015. Tom Walsh, business columnist for the Detroit Free Press. Always a pleasure, Tom. Thank you so much.
All right, Cindy. Take care.
What is the universe made of? It's kind of hard to find a more fundamental question than that. And Catherine Fries has devoted her life and her scientific career to finding the answer. Catherine Fries is a professor of physics at the University of Michigan, and her new book is called The Cosmic Cocktail, Three Parts Dark Matter. Welcome to Stateside.
Well, thank you for having me on the show.
Take us to that heart of that basic question, what is the universe made of? How do you attack that kind of a problem in a scientific way?
Well, the answer to the question, what is the universe made of, is very surprising. So let's start with the things that we do know in our daily experience. Your body, the air, the walls. Let's even throw in the stars and planets. All of that is made of atoms, but all of that adds up to only 5% of the universe.
That's stunning.
So we're trying to figure out what is the rest.
And how do you do that? When I think of a biological question that I might have, you can dissect a cadaver, you can do tissue tests, you can do animal studies. How do you figure out what that 95% is?
Well, we do have ways of weighing the universe. So the very first way that it was discovered that there was something missing dates all the way back to the 1930s. There was a man named Fritz Zwicky, a Swiss astronomer, who looked at clusters of galaxies, hundreds of galaxies in there, and they were moving, some were moving way too fast. So what he concluded was something was pulling on them. And he called that something dunkle materie, which means in German, dark matter. So he realized that there's something gravitationally pulling on stuff, making it speed up. So since that time, this is an 80-year-old problem, and we still don't know what it's made of, but it is dark.
Well, what has your research found? You're searching for what is dark matter. What does your research lead you to think?
This problem has been around for 80 years, and we feel like we're on the verge of detecting it. So we think that the dark matter is made of some new kind of fundamental particle, not neutrons, not protons, but something entirely new.
So nothing we studied in science class in school.
No, not yet. Hopefully in the next generation, because we're going to figure it out. So what my research has involved, oh, by the way, there's billions of particles, dark matter particles, going through your body every second. So this stuff is really pervasive.
And how do we know that?
Well, if it is the kind of particle that we think it is, we can do the calculations. I'm a theorist, and so I've done the math. How many of these things should there be in the universe? And I was involved in making proposals for, well, if you build a detector and you stick it deep underground to get rid of other competing signals, then these dark matter particles will hit your detector, scatter off, and you can measure the tiny recoil that your nucleus in your detector would have. So that's one thing that I did was propose that these ideas, did the theory, did the math, and then worldwide, tons of experiments looking for this stuff. And signals everywhere, but they can't all be right.
Yeah.
Are any of them right? So we're really excited. We're all jumping.
Well, in fact, it's funny. I noticed as I was reading articles about your book, about the Cosmic Cocktail, people would write, well, by the time you read this review, something else could have happened in this dark matter search. So it really is going at breakneck speed, isn't it?
You know, as I was writing the book, it felt like every month I had to change it and add something new. Some new experiment finding something new and potential discovery, but we're not sure yet.
All right. Take us out of the realm of the theoretical, if you will, and into the practical. So let's say you find the answer to the dark matter and dark energy questions, and you find out what is the universe made of. What does that mean in the everyday lives of people here on Earth?
I would give two answers to that question. The first one is that we are a curious species. We just plain want to know the answer to what is the universe made of. This is why humans have survived over the years, because we were curious enough to figure out how to make fire and all that kind of stuff. And this is the search, the exploration. That's who we are. And so I just have to work on this kind of problem. And I think the average person wants to know, wow, that people are surprised to hear that we only understand the 5%. Now, the second reason, and this is the reason that we're funded, is that there is always, always some kind of offshoot that comes, something serendipitous that you didn't expect that turns out to alter our lives. So I don't know what that's going to be until we figure this out. But it's also possible that en route to discovery, some of the technology that is necessary to build the experiments, that could have massive implications. That's the way that technology has always emerged. It's not that you went out and looked for transistors. They were an accidental byproduct of Bell Labs technology. They weren't looking for a better way to make phones. They happened to find transistors.
So
I can't tell you what it's going to be, but there will be something.
I am talking with Katie Fries, who is a professor of physics at the University of Michigan, and her book is The Cosmic Cocktail, Three Parts Dark Matter, really about her quest to answer the question, what is the universe made of? And your book shares some pretty jolly happenings at conferences and the like. And I'm wondering how much cooperation and sharing really happens amongst you and your colleagues.
When I wrote the book, The Cosmic Cocktail, I had two goals. And one is to talk about the science, the hunt for dark matter. But then along the way, I wanted to communicate the experience of being a scientist and the fun that we have. It's not like I sit in my room, shut the door, and never talk to anybody. Quite the opposite. The way that ideas happen is that we get together. I get together with friends that I work with, and we sit around, we bat ideas around, we brainstorm. Then you do some kind of back-of-the-envelope calculation, and you realize, well, that idea doesn't work, usually. But then every now and then something looks like, oh, this could be a good one, and then you pursue it, and you keep going until usually it fails, but you keep going, and every now and then you had an idea that works. And it's very collaborative, it's very fun, and I wanted to communicate that in the book.
So it's been decades that you've been in this field, and I'm wondering, in 1984, as you had that freshly minted PhD, you had to have been an anomaly. You had to have been, here is this blonde woman who likes to go to Studio 54. We learned that in your book. And here you are in the ranks of these male physicists. How are you regarded?
Honestly, it was really tough. I was one of the very first women to get an undergraduate degree from Princeton in physics. I was the first woman hired onto the faculty at the University of Michigan. And you just always feel out of place. You walk into a cafeteria, and especially at these giant particle accelerators, and 100 heads would turn. And your first instinct is, I don't belong here. I want to run away. And you have to overcome that to keep going. And it doesn't mean that people are against you. Actually, some of them are, because they didn't want to have these newcomers in
these
the ranks.
Women folk.
Yeah, so some people didn't. But on the whole, people were perfectly welcoming. But it's hard to overcome that barrier that you have internally to not fitting in. So
30 years later, you've earned your stripes and you do fit in, yes?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
What about today's young women? The students you're seeing today, what's the outlook for them and what's the reception for them? Has it gotten any better?
It has gotten better. It's still hard. I still see some of the same things. I see young girls who don't do well in freshman physics. And there's a lot of show-off behavior among the men because they're all insecure. Everybody's insecure. And the men know they're just showing off, and the women think, oh, I must be stupid, and they quit. So that's still ongoing, but you know, things have really improved. I don't know what the numbers are now for PhDs in physics, but I think it's something like 12% women or even more. So that's a big improvement. And policies have changed. When I had my baby, I was told, well, I was at MIT, our institution cannot afford one semester maternity leave. And so I actually was, that was bad. Mm. Now at Michigan, every junior faculty member gets a semester off, no questions asked. And the men are taking semesters off to take care of their newborns. Isn't that wonderful?
Mm-hmm.
The
mm-hmm.
world has changed.
And that's with women like you in the field kind of staking that ground.
Oh, I like to think so.
What about job prospects and career prospects for these students that you see coming into your classes? Let's talk about these undergrad students who might dare contemplate the idea of doing graduate work and getting a PhD in physics.
Oh, there is no better major. If you're just simply being practical, you will get a job. You will get an interesting job where you're doing something creative. So I can totally recommend it as a major. So when I see these young ladies, I say, follow your passion. Oh, for heaven's sake. Whether you pursue a career in academics or not, you can go to Wall Street. They love you because you have quantitative skills. They translate to or computer science or just everywhere. There's just a million things you can do. So if it's something you're passionate about, do it.
Katie Fries, University of Michigan physicist and soon to become director of NORDITA, a renowned theoretical physics institute in Stockholm. And her new book is The Cosmic Cocktail, Three Parts Dark Matter. Katie, thanks so much.
Well, thank you.
Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our director today was Allie Billings. Our engineer was Bob Scon. Contributors are Mike Blank, Emily Fox, Michelle Hahn, and Annie Norris. Support for arts and culture coverage on Stateside comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs and the National Endowment for the Arts. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you for listening.